Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Cindy. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, May 21st. Area's labor market totally recovers. Jobless rate in Midland is down to 3.2%, Odessa down to 4.8%, by Mella McEwen. 2 years after the pandemic sent Midland's labor market into a tailspin, the tall city has recorded a fairly rapid recovery. The Texas Workforce Commission Friday said unemployment in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, fell to 3.2% in April from 3.5% in March and is well below the 6.2% recorded last April. Odessa reported a similar trend, reporting an unemployment rate of 4.8%, down from 5.1% in March and well below the 9.1% seen last April. We have totally recovered from COVID, said Willie Taylor, Chief Executive Officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions, Permian Basin. We've made a tremendous turnaround. He added, we just don't have the workers, and that, he said, is keeping wages higher as well. Taylor said skilled workers, from those with commercial driver's licenses to auto mechanics, diesel mechanics, HVAC technicians and plumbers are in demand. It's a trend being seen not just in the Permian Basin, but across the state, Taylor said. Across Texas, we need to focus on growing our workforce, keeping our workforce, training our workforce, he said. We're getting close to the panic stage. And in critical areas like education and healthcare, he said, we're beyond catching up. Taylor noted that some 5,000 are expected to graduate this month and next from high schools across the 17 West Texas counties his office oversees. Hopefully, he said, some will stay in the area and work summer jobs before leaving for school or entering the military, and others will stay and attend local colleges. He also expressed hope those graduating from universities and colleges will stay or come to the area and work. That will be a real shot in the arm, he said. In his career, he said he has seen several tight labor markets, but I've not seen one this strong. Along with focusing on those graduating from high school or college, Taylor's office is working to bring those hindered by concerns like child care or training back into the workforce. If young single parents need help with child care, we still have child care dollars. Don't let child care be an issue, he said. Those who want to upgrade their skills, there's a lot of training dollars available. The region is a job seeker's market, he said. Anyone in the Permian Basin who wants to go to work can go to work. Midland's civilian labor force saw a decline of about 700 from March to April, and the number of employed fell by about 350, something Taylor attributed to data adjustments because it was seen statewide and nationwide as well. Still, the labor force is higher by 2,400 and the number of employed higher by 5,360 compared to last April. The number of unemployed fell by 300 and is down by 2,900 compared to a year ago. Midland added 700 jobs from March to April, led by 600 new jobs in the mining, logging, and construction sector, which comprises 30.9% of Midland's industrial sector. The financial activities sector, education and health services sector, leisure and hospitality sector, and other services sector each added 100 jobs. Trade, transportation, and utilities lost 200 jobs, and the government sector was down by 100 jobs. For the 12 months from April 2021 to April 2022, Midland added 6,800 jobs for a growth rate of 6.8%. growth was led by mining, logging, and construction, with 3,400 new jobs for a growth rate of 11.6%. Leisure and hospitality grew by 1,400 jobs, and trade, transportation, and utilities added 1,000 jobs. Professional and business services rose by 400, while the manufacturing sector and the other services sector each grew by 300. Financial activity saw 200 new jobs added. The only sector to see a loss was government, down by 200 jobs. Statewide, the unemployment rate fell to 4.3% from 4.4% in March. The state added 62,800 jobs in April and has added 742,000 jobs over the year. The state also reached a record high total non-farm job count for the sixth consecutive month, reporting 13,284,500 jobs in April. Amarillo and Austin Round Rock reported the state's lowest unemployment rate at 2.5% each, followed by College Station Bryan at 2.7%, then Lubbock at 2.8%. The highest unemployment was in McAllen Edinburgh Mission at 6.8%. Couple's bond is $1 million for infant's death, by Mercedes Cordero. A Midland couple has been arrested and charged with capital murder and the death of their one-month-old. Sarah Gilly Rowe, 19, and Byron Brown, 20, were arrested Thursday and charged with capital murder of a person under the age of 10. The Midland Police Department was notified on May 10th that a one-month-old was at Midland Memorial Hospital with a brain bleed and multiple skull fractures. The infant died of her injuries around 5 a.m. on May 11th. An MPD detective first interviewed Gilly Rowe, who told him that their 30-pound Mastiff Lab mix had jumped on the infant and put its paw on the infant's head. When interviewing Brown, he stated that he had left the apartment and tried to call Gilly Rowe to check in on her, but she didn't respond. After a few minutes, she called back and told him something was wrong with the infant and that the infant wasn't breathing right. He also stated they called 911, but paramedics told them nothing was wrong and left. Midland Fire Department paramedics were dispatched a second time to their apartment because the infant was not responding. Paramedics transported the infant to MMH, according to the affidavit. Gilly Rowe and Brown were transported to the Midland Police Department, where they didn't provide any further explanation to the infant's injuries. Detectives determined that Gilly Rowe and Brown were the only two people that were with the infant before calling 911. Detectives issued an arrest warrant after an autopsy determined the cause of death was a homicide. Bond has been set at $1 million for both Gilly Rowe and Brown. The investigation is ongoing. Commission Shift Aims to Shift RRC Thinking, by Mella McEwen. Across the state, a year-old organization is working to shift Texans' thinking about the Railroad Commission and how its three elected commissioners oversee the state's oil and gas industry. Executive Director Virginia Palacios of Commission Shift was in Midland this week to address the Petroleum Accountants Society of the Permian Basin, and she told the Reporter-Telegram they were surprised when she told them how many abandoned wells were located in the state. At the end of 2021, there were 7,000 orphaned wells, and at the end of April, there were 8,000, she said, so there are already 1,000 more wells. The Texas legislature routinely gives the commission a set number of wells to plug using state funds that are provided by bonds paid by operators. Palacios said the commission routinely exceeds that number, but new additions to the list outpace the wells that are plugged. In an ideal world, operators would plan for the decline of the well, she said. They plot how the cost of operating the well equals the revenue and need to plan to plug the well once cost exceeds revenue. She criticized the agency for routinely approving applications to extend the deadline for operators to plug wells and said operators need to get a handle on their inactive wells. They don't have enough political will for the Railroad Commission to get to that point of being stricter on extending deadlines. Unfortunately, Palacios said she is detecting a theme that abandoned wells are becoming a generational problem. She cited one woman whose father had worked for decades to get wells on his property plugged, and after he passed away, she was forced to carry on the fight. While in Midland, she took the opportunity to tour Lake Bomer in Crane County, where polluted water has been flowing. She described seeing a sulfur well surrounded by blackened vegetation and dead spots where vegetation around wells had died. The land around the wells is unusable, she said. These problems persist for generations. Even if the wells are plugged, the damage has been done and won't be undone for generations. Palacios speculated that the next legislative session may bring about changes in the commission's bonding requirements to help fund plugging wells. The agency, she said, estimates it spends $10.60 per foot to plug a well that is an average of 4,000 feet, but the bonds they currently receive only cover about $2 per foot. That leaves quite a gap between what the bonds fund and the actual cost, she said. When shale wells have to be plugged, she pointed out that they are deeper and will cost considerably more to plug. One reason operators are reluctant to plug idled wells is they want to hold on to their leases, Palacios said. That's a disservice to mineral owners if the operator keeps zombie wells just to hang on to the lease, she said. She is also critical that the three elected commissioners all seem to have financial interest in the industry they oversee, as reported in their filings and their election campaigns receive contributions from the industry. She said she would like to see the commissioners subject to the same limitations state judges face when they run for office, like recusal from cases before the commission if the company involved contributed more than $1,000 to the commissioner's campaign, or not taking contributions during an 18-month period around the election. That way, she said, there won't be contributions made during the decision-making process. While the year-old organization's initial focus was around abandoned wells, Palacios said Commission Shift will be turning its attention to the Commission's efforts to be delegated authority to oversee carbon dioxide injection wells by the Environmental Protection Agency. We have real concerns with the Railroad Commission overseeing CO2 injection because of the disaster wastewater injection has been, Palacios said, pointing to the reports of water pollution as well as increase in seismic activity connected to water injection. Yarbrough is Midland's life changer. Legendary educator wins nationwide grand prize. South Elementary parent liaison and longtime member of the Midland ISD family, Barbara Yarbrough, has been selected as a Life Changer of the Year Grand Prize winner. Yarbrough was selected as the Grand Prize winner out of more than 850 nominations for K-12 school employees from across the country. In total, she wins a $10,000 cash prize, which will be awarded as a $5,000 personal award and a $5,000 donation to a nonprofit of her choice. Yarbrough was nominated by Peace Elementary Counselor David Cook, who led the campaign to have Yarbrough recognized for this award. Life Changer of the Year is a national program sponsored by National Life Group that annually recognizes and rewards K-12 school district educators and employees who make a difference in the lives of students by exemplifying excellence, positive influence, and leadership. Each year, the Life Changer of the Year program receives hundreds of nominations from all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Midland woman dies after collision in Martin County. A 63-year-old Midland woman died after a collision Monday in Martin County, according to DPS troopers. The collision took place 28 miles north of Midland on State Highway 176, around 4:55 p.m., according to DPS. Michelle August was driving a Chevy Silverado 1500 west on State Highway 176. DPS also reported a 2017 Ford F-350 was traveling east when August's vehicle traveled into oncoming traffic in the eastbound lane and collided with the Ford. August was taken to Martin County Hospital, where she passed away. The driver of the other vehicle was identified as a member of the Texas DPS. She was treated and released from the hospital. Both drivers were wearing their seatbelts, according to DPS. Holy Cross breaks ground on Tomlin Gym. Holy Cross Catholic High School held a groundbreaking ceremony for the Tomlin Gym this week. Holy Cross also held its third annual Black and Gold Ball on May 14th. Holy Cross is located at 4014 Todd Drive in East Midland. The mission of Holy Cross Catholic High School is to be a beacon of excellent Catholic education for the youth of the Permian Basin, according to the school's website. We challenge each student to live as a Christian witness in service to others. We form young men and women spiritually, academically, socially, and physically in accordance with the teachings of the Catholic Church. Obituaries and death notices from the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday. Domingo Ramos Pena, 71, of Midland, passed away May 16th. He was born on September 20th, 1950, to Jovita and Esteban Pena in Floresville, Texas. Domingo is survived by his beloved wife, Mary Pena, son Eric Pena and wife Jessica Rodriguez, Edgar Pena and Mara Pena, three granddaughters, three great-grandchildren, sisters Gloria Valdez, Minnie Trevino, Dolores Lopez, Olga Castro, Diana Lucio, Anita Salgado, Adela Castro, brothers Steve Pena, Luis Pena, Chris Pena, Robert Pena, and a host of nieces, nephews, and friends. Viewing will be on Monday, May 23rd at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m., with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will take place on Tuesday, May 24th at 2 p.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine Catholic Church. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Today, May 18th, Lord, You Called Me Home. I was born on February 27th, 1967, to Estanislado Espinoza and Delma Ramirez in Midland. I married the love of my life, Naomi N. Espinoza. We then had our son, Michael Fabian Espinoza. I gained additional family members, my little Emma Nicole Espinoza, granddaughter. I have a sister, Belinda Brown, a nephew, and a niece. I had also had many other family members and friends. A celebration of life was held Sunday, May 22nd, at La Comunidad Church in Midland. Nelda Stewart, age 85, of Midland, peacefully passed away Wednesday, May 18th, after a brief illness in Midland. Nelda was born January 6, 1937, in Santa Ana, Texas, to John X. and Abby Barker Stewart. Funeral services for Nelda were held Sunday, May 22nd, at Leatherwood Memorial Chapels in Brady, with James D. Stewart officiating. graveside services were held at the Rockwood Cemetery in Rockwood. Friends may view and or sign Nelda's online memorial guestbook at www.leatherwoodmemorialchapels.com. Nelda Stewart is survived by son Steve Turner and wife Nancy of Ruidosa, New Mexico, daughter Kim Turner Pohl of Midland, sister Renee Avance of Brady, a grandson and two granddaughters and their children. Memorial contributions in memory of Nelda may be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, 262 Danny Thomas Place, Memphis, Tennessee, 38105, or online at www.stjude.org. Rodney Ray Maxson went to be with his Lord and Savior May 17th at Midland Memorial Hospital. He was born in Arkansas City, Kansas, June 19, 1929, to Noble Maxson and Violet Reed Maxson. Rod was preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, and his youngest daughter, Tammy. He is survived by his wife, Millie, daughter Deborah Lawrence of Midland, son Kent, and wife Cindy Maxson of Nashville, Tennessee, daughter Joan and husband Steve Mayo of Denison, Texas. He is also survived by 11 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Services will be Friday, May 27th at 1 p.m. at Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Midland. Interment of ashes will be a private family ceremony earlier that morning. Memorials may be made to Holy Cross Lutheran Church or the charity of your choice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Theodore Otto Schmidt, born November 3, 1933, went to join his Heavenly Father on May 18th. A memorial service will be held Wednesday, May 25th at Holy Cross Lutheran Church at 10 a.m. Ted was born to Otto Herman Schmidt and Lois Smith Schmidt in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He idolized his older brother, Richard Herman Schmidt. His loving wife, Sue, and his devoted family will cherish his memory. Three sons, Eric and wife Esperanza, Kevin and wife Amy, Carl and wife Doris, and daughter Linda and Adam. He was grandfather to four and two great-granddaughters. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that you consider making a donation to Holy Cross Lutheran Church, or a charity of your choice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Diamond Michelle Royal, Roe, 6 weeks of Midland, passed away on May 11th at Midland Memorial Hospital in Midland. Diamond was born on March 31st to Byron and Sarah Michelle Roe in Midland. She is survived by her parents, maternal grandparents Wanda Ann Green and Jeff McCowan, and Keisha McMarion, great-grandparents Melissa McMarion, Kat and J.J. Jackson, and her great-aunt and uncle Lavonda Johnson and Henry Lee. She is preceded in death by her grandmother Robbie Rowe. A celebration of life will be held on Tuesday, May 24th at 11 a.m., at American Heritage Funeral Home, with Lavonda Johnson Lee officiating, burial immediately following at American Heritage Cemetery. John Albert Martinez, 19, of Midland, passed away Tuesday, May 17th. Viewing will be held Sunday, May 22nd, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a celebration of life to begin 7 p.m. Sunday evening at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Funeral service is set for Monday, May 23rd at 10 a.m. at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements were made with the Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Rosalie Rose Snyder, 67, of Midland, passed away May 19th. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Jane, reading for the Saturday Odessa American, May 21st. Pfluger's bill would reform energy policy. Obstacles should be removed from interstate pipeline construction, Congressman says. U.S. Representative August Pfluger has a fight on his hands with his recently filed American Energy Freedom Act, which would cut red tape for oil and gas projects and facilitate interstate pipelines between the Permian Basin and Lee and Eddy counties in eastern New Mexico. With the Democrats in Washington holding a 222-213 majority in the House and a 50-50 split in the Senate, where Vice President Kamala Harris breaks ties, the Sinangelo Republican concedes that it is a tough go. But he says there are enough Democrats in the energy-producing areas of Texas, New Mexico, and other states that his House Resolution number 7094 should get some bipartisan support. Noting that an identical bill has been filed by the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Pfluger said, "This complements my Midland over Moscow bill, and it goes a step further in a couple of instances because we are still seeing a full-scale assault on the energy industry by the Biden administration." Jen Psaki, the former White House press secretary, said 2 weeks ago that they were doubling down on their efforts for climate change. "So our motivation is to make sure we fight back against all the ways they are weaponizing different things against the industry." Pfluger said his proposals will be debated mostly in the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, to which he aspires to be appointed, but some provisions may be considered by other committees. Just having brought Energy and Commerce Ranking Member Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State here to see the oil and gas business up close, he said many members of Congress have accepted his leadership and could consult him on energy issues, including several who have signed on as co-sponsors of the American Energy Freedom Act. Paradoxically, Pfluger said, President Biden encouraged the construction of Russian President Vladimir Putin's Nord Stream 2 pipeline till Germany stopped it, and Biden is asking the People's Republic of China to build more coal plants while he's killing the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada and scuttling other domestic projects. The congressman said he didn't know why the president and other radical environmentalists see American pipelines as being sinister. "Pipelines are the safest way to move oil and gas," he said. "The administration is very misguided on this issue. They're harming Americans at the gasoline pumps and harming them in the pocketbook. District 11 is the epicenter of geopolitics around the world, and we are the solution for easing the inflationary pressures by providing fuels in a responsible, affordable manner. My job is to lead the charge in Washington and help the American public see how important the Permian Basin is to our economy and our security." Here are the American Energy Freedom Act principal features. Prohibit the president from unilaterally enacting leasing bans on federal lands. Eliminate the presidential permit requirement for cross-border energy projects on federal lands and waters. Mandate the onshore and offshore oil, gas, wind, solar, and geothermal lease sales that have been blocked since January 2021. Expedite permitting and add certainty to the scope of environmental reviews. Reduce foreign dependence for critical minerals by expanding access and streamlining permitting. Require the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the U.S. Department of Energy to review permits to export liquefied natural gas within 60 days and immediately approve pending permits to export LNG through 2025. Require FERC and the Army Corps of Engineers to complete permitting for interstate natural gas projects in 1 year or less and prohibit the rejection of a natural gas pipeline if the project meets safety regulations. And end regulatory uncertainty by putting into law the 2020 U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's and Army Corps of Engineers' definition of the waters of the United States, the EPA's 2020 methane rule, the 2021 valuation rule for oil and gas production on federal lands, the 2020 Council on Environmental Quality, and the 2021 Corps of Engineers pipeline rule. Post-COVID clinic being offered at MCH. Those who are still suffering with long COVID in the Odessa-Midland area may not be aware of a post-COVID clinic that is currently available at MCH. Since December, local pulmonologist Dr. Kavar Dar of Odessa Medical Enterprises and his team have been teaming up with Medical Center Hospital, operating a post-COVID clinic at the Wheatley Stewart Medical Pavilion on the MCHS campus. The idea of the clinic is to help patients who have contracted COVID-19 and are dealing with lingering after effects. Dar and his team have been working with Director of Pulmonology Resources at MCH, Dr. Renato Galindo, with this clinic. I think from my point of view, we just want to let them know that we can address most long-term consequences of COVID, Dr. Dar said. We're here as a resource. We would like to help. Going back to the initial point, we want it to be a service to our community. It's gone through a lot. That was the goal MCH had. We were on the same page as far as that was concerned and helped those who have suffered through the illness. Galindo and his team have been instrumental in helping partner up. Dar said the idea for the clinic originally came during the first wave. I had presented it to the administration here at ORMC because we were having large volumes of patients in the hospital who were getting discharged but really lacked follow-up of any kind, Dr. Dar said. One of the problems of that time was that clinics were not seeing patients directly in the office. They were getting largely ignored in a way because a lot of them needed specific care, in addition to simple things like titrating their oxygen levels and getting them back to work, and so on. That was my idea at the time, but it didn't catch on. Then last year, Dar approached the subject again and said it didn't go through. He then brought it up with Chief Nursing Officer at MCH, Kristen Timmons. She thought it was a wonderful idea, Dr. Dar said. There was a need in the community because during the Omicron wave, there was such a large volume of inpatients, and they were getting discharged and really no clear follow-up for them. The primary care physicians are very good in the area, but there are other things they lack the expertise in. So we thought this would be a good idea to serve the community during the 2 years of the pandemic. As a pulmonologist, Dr. Dar is certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine and carries a subspecialty in critical care medicine and pulmonary disease. Dr. Dar and Galindo have treated many COVID patients during and post-infections. During the wave, we helped a lot of patients, Dar said. Through this time, we've been helping a lot of patients. We do inpatient work, too. We see them from the beginning to the end. Those that get discharged from the hospital, we follow them up at the clinic. We've helped them in different ways. We've been treating the symptoms. We've been treating specific illnesses associated with COVID. Then administrative things like getting them back to work, establish their suitability to going back to the kind of work they were doing previously, and so on. That was the idea. We could have done this by ourselves in our offices, but we wanted it to be something that the hospital can do to serve the community. The clinic takes place every Thursday at the Wheatley Stewart Medical Pavilion on the MCHS campus. Usually the clinic is open in the afternoons, but if there's a large volume of patients, it'll sometimes be open all day. In half a day, we see 15 to 20 patients, Dr. Dar said. They require a little bit of care and some detailed evaluations. We do comprehensive evaluations of everything. We don't just do lung symptoms. We do neurological symptoms. Many patients who have COVID continue to struggle with symptoms even after infection, including headaches, joint pain, coughing, shortness of breath, and brain fog, as well as heart palpitations, chest pain, and skin issues. lot of people have symptoms of brain fog, Dar said. Some have chronic headaches, and others still have difficulty with taste and smell. Some have joint pains. We try to address everything that we can. The number of outpatients they have treated at the clinic did go up during the recent wave of the pandemic due to word of mouth about the clinic's existence. Dar wants people who are suffering with long COVID in the area to know that they don't have to travel to faraway places such as Dallas or San Antonio unless it's necessary. We never advertised, and it was just limited to patients leaving Medical Center Hospital. It's grown by word of mouth, but we really want the community to know it's available. They don't need to go out of town to get the kind of care that's required for a lot of the patients who are requiring long-term treatment or have symptoms that have persisted. We get patients who contracted COVID back in 2020. We've had patients who had long-term COVID, and we manage them. They don't have to go to Dallas. Galindo said that some of their patients have been waiting for answers to their COVID questions for almost a year. When they come in here, if it's any specific testing, we can get it all done in one day, Galindo said. Whether it's an X-ray or a CT scan, it can all be done in one visit. We set that up with Dr. Dar. Another item Galindo addressed was people with long-term COVID asking about when they will return to normal. I think the biggest things people have been asking, when do we get back to normal since the pandemic started, Galindo said. Unfortunately, there are people who have been asking what normal will be like for their long-term COVID symptoms. That's why we partnered up. We want to give those people the answers and let them know what the normal is for them. Appointments are mandatory to be seen. People can call 432-332-5557 to make an appointment. All insurances are accepted. The patients can call up and make an appointment, said nurse practitioner Jeanette Garcia. They just call and specify that they need a post-COVID appointment. They don't need a referral from their primary care. Pet lovers continue pitch to City of Odessa. Years ago, Karen Patterson found a dog on the side of the road and decided to drop him off at the Odessa Animal Shelter. The certified public accountant changed her mind as soon as she learned the shelter had a high euthanasia rate. She kept the dog, named him Roscoe, and 2 years ago, she started Fix West Texas. Fix West Texas is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing low-cost spaying and neutering services, microchips, and vaccinations to folks in Odessa, Midland, and beyond. After meeting Roscoe that day, Patterson said she quickly discovered there were no low-cost clinics in the area. Veterinarians were charging anywhere from $300 to $900 to spay and neuter dogs and had long, long wait lines due to a shortage of vets in the area. So Patterson said she and a friend decided to help address the problem on their own. They called around and found a handful of vets who were willing to sign a contract and take turns to fly into Midland for a few days at a time to provide services. Originally, Patterson and her co-founder operated 4 to 5 days a month, moving from the Odessa Police Department's annex to Floyd Gwynn Park to the Midland Horseshoe Arena. Now, thanks to 2 grants, donations, and service revenues, Fix West Texas has a home in Midland, and they strive to open 20 days a month, the dates of which are announced on Facebook. The organization has an annual budget of roughly $1 million, 12 paid employees, and 4 volunteers. Since its inception, roughly 11,000 spays and neuters have been performed, and each animal is microchipped and vaccinated at the same time. Many of the surgeries performed are tied to a voucher program funded by the City of Midland and Midland County, Patterson said. The city last year provided Fix West Texas $230,000, and the county supplied $150,000, so qualifying residents can obtain a $70 voucher toward the cost of a spay or neuter. These vouchers essentially cover the cost of the surgery. Now Patterson wants to convince the City of Odessa and Ector County to do the same thing. Patterson pitched her idea to the Odessa City Council last month and intends to do the same Tuesday night. Now that the city has invested in a new shelter, Patterson said she thinks it's time to address the reason why the shelter is always filled with stray, lost, and abandoned cats and dogs. Now's the time where we can change our practices and invest in preventing the births instead of housing and then killing half of those we house, because right now we're spending a lot of money on housing animals just to kill them, Patterson told the council on April 19th. She also expressed her disappointment that the city opted not to sign a memo of understanding with Best Friends Animal Society, a national nonprofit that provided the city a 15-page analysis of the current shelter's operations and wanted to teach shelter employees best practices by embedding an employee at the shelter for up to a year. Best Friends was willing to provide $100,000 worth of services to the city for free in order to help the city reach a 90% live release rate. Right now, animal control officers euthanize more than 50% of the animals they find in the field or see at the shelter, Patterson said. She said at the meeting the city rejected the idea because they didn't want to abdicate responsibilities to another agency. Shelter director Kelly Hendricks is doing a fine job, they said. The contract's really not up to set a replacement shelter director. It's someone to advise the animal shelter. So, as a partnership, I hate that Kelly sees it that way. But when you're euthanizing 52% of animals, I would beg for help and to have someone say, here's free help valued at $100,000. And our city said, no, we don't really want that because our guy's doing good. We've gone from 30% kill to 50% kill. I can't get my head wrapped around that, Patterson said. She questioned Hendricks' job qualification and why such a large number of dogs are being euthanized for being aggressive. Best Friends could help animal control officers determine which animals are truly aggressive and which ones are acting aggressively simply because of the circumstances they found themselves in at the shelter. In addition to providing recommendations to city staff in terms of medical care, housing, cleaning products, and bookkeeping practices, Best Friends also identified communication and culture issues within the shelter. In a report written in February 2021, the shelter staff distrust the community to a certain extent, going so far as to create a do not adopt list, prohibited by anyone who has returned an animal from ever adopting again. The report's authors went on to say the staff has a lack of understanding about the role of today's animal control agency and suffers from compassion fatigue and burnout. Too many duties were being handled by too few people, and the current volunteer and foster programs lack formal structure. There are no official trainings, no handbooks, no shadowing or mentoring programs, the report said. In addition, new programs were introduced without training and explanation, and there were silos within the various departments, the report stated. More than 4,500 animals were euthanized overall last year in Odessa, and 52,000 killed statewide, Patterson said. Working with rescue groups is great, but it won't solve the issue, she told the council. We always say we can't adopt our way out of the problem. We can't transport our way out of the problem. The only thing we can really do is reduce, literally. We have to reduce the unwanted litters, Patterson said. The responsible thing to do is spay and neuter, and that's what we're hoping you guys can help with, that we can really communicate to the city residents that this time this is what the city wants. We don't want to add any more stray, free-roaming dogs. We want to be able to use our parks. We want our kids to be able to enjoy our parks, and we also want it to be a healthy place for our pets. Odessa Police Chief Michael Gerke and Council Member Detra White defended shelter manager Kelly Hendricks and her staff in interviews last week and said the city is doing the best it can with a difficult situation, especially given a lack of resources. The city did not sign an agreement with Best of Friends because Hendricks has already implemented many of the suggestions the organization provided, they said. Those people that work at the shelter, those employees, they care about their job. They are some of the lowest paid employees in the city of Odessa. they didn't care about their job, they wouldn't be doing that great. Certainly, they could find other jobs that are paying more and they would be less stressful. It just is what it is, Gerke said. There were some management issues when Hendricks took over the shelter, but she's worked them out. In addition, there hasn't been any disease outbreaks at the shelter in more than a year. That fact stands on its own, Gerke said. The chief also insisted that 98% of the animals euthanized by the city are ill or injured. White agreed and said that because diseases like parvo are so highly contagious, the shelter staff simply can't run the risk of them spreading shelter-wide. In addition, trying to nurse them back to health is also an expensive proposition. The chief said he believes there is simply a personality conflict between Patterson and Hendricks. The bottom line is everyone agrees more people need to be spaying and neutering their animals. The question remains, however, what is the best way to make sure that gets done? Patterson believes most people aren't getting their animals fixed due to resources. Gerke and White think most people just are philosophically opposed to doing so. I would love to be a no-kill shelter. I don't think we'll ever get to that point, but I'd love to get us as close as we possibly can, Gerke said. We've kind of taken a step back from where we were. We have lost some ground, but we're going to make that ground up. Our goal is to work hard, but I think criticizing the staff and creating an atmosphere where there's more friction, we're all trying to work toward the same goal. The last thing you want to do, to me, is hurt those relationships. You try to build relationships, not burn them down. The deal with Best Friends wouldn't have been appropriate, Gerke said. They did give some advice. We followed some of their advice. It's just when we got down to signing contracts, some of the things they wanted we didn't find acceptable. Basically, they wanted more or less control of the shelter, and the fact that those are tax dollars paid by citizens of Odessa, I'm okay with being advised. I just don't think that it was appropriate to turn that over. Gerke said the city is doing its best to educate the community about responsible pet ownership, such as spaying and neutering animals, microchipping them, and getting them vaccinated through Facebook, the city's website, and through speaking engagements. If money were no issue, Gerke said he'd love to have a veterinarian on staff at the shelter to perform procedures and even to go out into the community to hold vaccination clinics. But money is an issue. Right now, the city contracts with a Colorado City vet who performs procedures once a week at the shelter. It turns out that that arrangement is more cost-effective than using Fix West Texas, he said. As for a voucher program, Gerke said he'd want to make sure the citizens most in need would benefit, but noted there are a lot of other departments within the city that have needs and will be asking for additional funding this season. I know each department is going to come forth with some requests. I mean, I think we all know that there's issue with infrastructure, with roads and water and sewer lines and things like that, Gerke said. White expressed similar thoughts. I'm not against the voucher program. I'm not against it, but I don't know how much we would be able to provide them, White said. We're talking about tax money, you know, and so we have to be good stewards of that. It's kind of one of those stand in line. Habitat for Humanity has approached us many times with their needs. We have the food bank. We have so many entities, and now that groceries have gone so high, we have gasoline, and we have to be good stewards.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read articles from the inside pages of the Odessa American, published Saturday, May 21st. ECISD graduations set. Ector County ISD has scheduled graduations for George H.W. Bush New Tech Odessa, Permian, and Odessa High Schools. New Tech's commencement is at 7 p.m. May 25th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Permian High School's graduation is at 8:30 p.m. May 27th at Ratliff Stadium. Odessa High School's graduation is at 8:30 p.m. May 28th at Ratliff Stadium. Reward offered for man making terroristic threats. The Texas Department of Public Safety announced via press release Friday afternoon an increased reward for fugitive Hardy Carroll Lloyd, who is wanted for making terroristic threats. Texas Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward of up to $1,000 for information that leads to Lloyd's arrest. All tips are guaranteed to be anonymous. Lloyd, 44, is wanted by authorities after posting a series of threatening comments online where he promises to carry a firearm onto the Texas State Capitol grounds this weekend and challenge any law enforcement officer who tries to take enforcement actions against him. Lloyd is a convicted felon and cannot legally carry a firearm. Lloyd of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is 5'11" and weighs about 250 pounds. He is known as a white supremacist. Texas Crime Stoppers, which is funded by the governor's Criminal Justice Division, offers cash rewards to any person who provides information that leads to the arrest of a suspect responsible for a particular crime. To be eligible for cash rewards, tipsters must provide information to authorities using one of two methods. Call the Crime Stoppers hotline at 1-800-252-TIPS. Submit a tip online. All tips are anonymous, regardless of how they are submitted, and tipsters will be provided a tip number instead of using a name. Ellen Noel announces return of Teen Artist Residency Program. The Teen Artist Residency Program at the Ellen Noel Art Museum is making a return for summer 2022. TARP is an intensive one-week summer art program which lasts from June 6th to June 10th, the press release detailed. It offers students ages 13 to 17 a unique art experience in a museum setting, working alongside papier-mâché artist Manuel Urrieta. Selected students will spend the week with Urrieta creating papier-mâché masks and creatures, the press release stated. Selected students will have an opportunity to work in a fun and interactive environment while exploring new techniques and developing their artistic creativity. Students must apply and be accepted into this program. Applications can be found on the museum's website, noelartmuseum.org/programs, and are due by May 23rd. The museum education staff will choose applicants based on completed applications, teacher recommendations, and personal interviews when needed. All program decisions are confidential and final. Applications received after the deadline of May 23rd may not be considered. Teen Artist Residency Program dates and deadlines: May 23rd, application due or postmarked. May 25th, notification of acceptance. June 2nd, payment of $100 due and acceptance agreement signed and returned. June 5th, 3:30 p.m., private welcoming reception for Manuel Urrieta, students, and parents. June 6th to 10th, 1:30 p.m. to 4 p.m., Teen Artists Residency Program. June 10th, 5:30 p.m., pop-up art installation and opening reception for TARP students and public.
Leslie Ann Hitt of Highland Village passed away on May 11th, 2022. Leslie Ann is survived by her dad, Norman B. Hitt, formerly of Odessa, now in Highland Village, and her sister, Lisa Hitt, of Highland Village. She is preceded in death by her mom, Lou Ann Hitt, her maternal grandparents, Jesse and Ruth Kirk, and her paternal grandparents, Basil and Leela Hitt. Leslie Ann was born on February 5th, 1963, in Odessa. A celebration of her life will be held at Mulkey Mason Funeral Home in Lewisville, Texas, on Monday, May 23rd at 1 p.m. Leslie Ann donated to many charities, with her favorites being the Heifer Foundation and local food banks. Please choose a charity you love for a donation in lieu of flowers, if you like. Janet LaRue Franklin, 70, of Whitney, passed away Friday, May 13th. She was born in Snyder, Texas, on January 24th, 1952, to Jewel and LaRue Franklin. Janet is survived by her three children, Megan Riston, Jared Riston, and Micah Gelber, and her brother, Jay. Janet was preceded in death by her parents. A memorial service will be held for Ms. Franklin at White Bluff Chapel on Monday, May 23rd at 10 a.m. Thomas Vernon Mouse Fraley in Midland died at the age of 55 on May 7th. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. May 28th at West Acres Funeral Chapel. John and Ashley Weimar are officiating. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.